द नेक्स्ट सब हेडिंग ऑफ दिस चैप्टर इज वायोलेशन ऑफ यूनिटीज ड्रिडेंस जस्टिफिकेशन कंपैरिजन विथ जॉनसन ड्रिडेंस लिबरलिज्म हिज फ्री क्रिटिकल डिस्पोजिशन इज बेस्ट सीन इन हिज जस्टिफिकेशन ऑफ द वायोलेशन ऑफ द थ्री यूनिटीज ऑफ टाइम प्लेस एंड एक्शन ऑन द पार्ट ऑफ द इंग्लिश ड्रामेटिस्ट and in his defense of English tragic comedy. As regards the unities, his view is that point A, the English violation of the unities lends greater copiousness and variety to the English plays. The unities have a narrowing and cramping effect on the French plays, and they are often betrayed into absurdities from which the English plays are free. Point B. The English disregard of unities enables them to present a more just and lively picture of human nature. The French plays may be more regular, but they are not so lively. In other words, their representation is not so pleasant and delightful as that of English. Then point C. Shakespeare's plays are more true to nature and more delightful than any French play, even though he has not observed the unities. Then point D. The English, which they do observe the rules, as Ben Jonson has gone in The Silent Women, show greater skill and art than the French. The Silent Women is as regular as any French play, and yet is entirely free from the absurdities of the latter. It all depends upon the genius or skill or the writer. Point E. There is no harm in introducing by concernments or subplots, for they impart variety, richness, and copiousness to the play. In this way, the writer can present a more just picture of nature than the French with their narrow and cramped plays. And point F, to the view that observance of the unities is justified on the ground that their violation results in improbability and it places too great a strain on the imagination of the spectators, and that credibility is stretched too far, he replies that it is all a question of dramatic illusion. At one place, Dryden asks why should he imagine the soul of a man more heavy than his senses. This sentence, says Davis Datchet, is worthy to stand beside Dr. Johnson's letter. He that imagines this much may imagine more. Dr. Johnson says the last word on the problem of dramatic illusion when he says the spectators are always in their senses and they know full well that the stage is a stage and the play is a play. They credit the drama with all the credit due to a drama. It is accredited whenever it moves as a just picture of a real original, as representing to the auditor what he would himself feel if he were to do or suffer what is there figened, figned, to be suffered or to be done. The reflection that strikes the heart is not that the evils before us are real evils, but that they are evils to which we ourselves may be exposed. If there be any fallacy It is not what we fancy the players to be unhappy, but that we fancy ourselves unhappy for a moment. But we rather lament the possibility that suppose the presence of misery, as a mother weeps over her baby, when she imagines that death may take it away from her. The delight of tragedy proceeds from our consciousness of fiction. If we thought murders and treasons real, they would please no more. Imitations produce pain or pleasure not because they are mistaken for realities, but because they bring realities to mind. Thus, in this respect, Dryden anticipates Johnson, though he doesn't say all this clearly and elaborately. But this view is implied in the sentence quoted above. In short, Dryden's view of the unities amounts to this: the rules of Aristotle are not absolute. There is always an appeal open from rules to nature. If the ends of drama are better fulfilled by a violation of the unities, then there is no harm in violating them. Shakespeare has produced more just and lively plays, even though he has utterly disregarded the unities. The next subheading is Justification of Tragicomedy, Comparison with Dr. Johnson. The same liberalism, the same openness of outlook, the same freedom from slavery to rules is also displayed in Dryden's defense of the English tragicomedy. He defends tragicomedy on the following grounds. A. The contraries, when placed near, set off each other. B. Continued gravity depresses the spirit. The scene of mirth thrown in between refreshes. It has the same effect on us as music. In other words, comic senses provide dramatic relief, though Dryden doesn't explicitly say so. And C. Mirth doesn't destroy compassion, that is, the serious effects which tragedy aims at. Point D. Just as the eye can pass from an unpleasant object to a pleasant one, so also the shawl can move from the tragic to the comic, and much more swiftly. Then point E. The English have perfected a new way of writing not known to the ancients. If they had tragic comedies, perhaps Aristotle would have revised his rules. And point F. It is all a question of progress, of a change of tastes. The ancients cannot be model for all times and countries. What pleased the Greeks would not satisfy an English audience. Had Aristotle seen our plays, he might have changed his mind. The real test of excellence is not strict adherence to rules or conventions, but whether the aims of drama have been achieved. The views of Dryden on tragicomedy may now be compared with those of Dr. Johnson on this subject, expressed in his preface to Shakespeare. He accepts Dryden's views that the mingling of the tragic and the comic provides dramatic relief. But he makes a further point which is foreshadowed in Dryden, but which has not been clearly stated. He appeals to nature. Tragicomedy is true to nature, for in nature also good and evil, joy and sorrow mingle in countless modes and ways. Dryden himself had hinted at this very truth to nature while defending the irregularities of the English drama in general against the cold formality of the French stage. next is conclusion. To conclude, Dryden is a liberal classicist who doesn't consider rules as an end in themselves, but merely as a means to good writing. The free play between theory and practice which we find in Dryden's criticism is one sign of his superiority to the ordinary professional critic of his or any other time. The next point and next subheading of this chapter is Dryden as the father of English criticism. His achievements as a critic. It was Dr. Johnson who first called Dryden the father of English criticism, as the writer who first taught us to determine upon principles the merit of composition, and critic after critic has agreed with his estimate. Not that there was no criticism in England before Dryden. There had been critics like Sir Philip Sidney and Ben Jonson, but they were critics merely by chance. Their critical works are merely occasional utterances on the critical art. Sidney's apology arose out of the need to defend poetry against Puritan attacks, and the learned Ben's critical utterances are in the nature of jottings of just a few things that interested him. It is Dryden who began a regular era of criticism. It is for the first time in him that criticism becomes self-conscious, becomes aware of itself, analyzes its objects with sympathy and knowledge, and knowing what kind of thing it is looking for. Despite the scattered nature of his criticism, the essay on dramatic poesy, being the only formal work of criticism he ever wrote, his critical pronouncements cover every field of literary problem and every aspect of literature. Drama, epic, tragedy, comedy, tragicomedy, nature and function of poetry all receive due attention from him. Moreover, the earlier criticism was magisterial or dogmatic. They claim to lay down rules for the guidance of poets and writers, rules which were dogmatically asserted. Most of the critical works, Sidney's apology is an exception, were addressed to poets and writers rather than to the readers. Critics considered that they alone were in the right, while all others were in the wrong. Dryden, on the other hand, is never magisterial or pontific. He is skeptical. He doesn't lay down the rules. He rather sets out to discover the rules for his guidance in writing plays, as well as in judging of those written by others. He rather derides those who are dogmatic or too sure in knowing the correct thing. The skeptical tone of his criticism is but a reflection of his personality, gentle, modest, unassuming, intelligent, free from dogmatism and vanity of any kind. The earlier English criticism was either theoretical or legislative. The critics were merely content to lay down the rules. It is Dryden who inaugurated the era of descriptive criticism. It was quality for the function by which qualified for the function by his wide reading and learning. He had not only read and digested Sophocles, Euripides, Theocritus and Virgil, but also Shakespeare, Ben Jonson, Fletcher and a host of other writers, both ancient and modern. It is in his criticism that literary analysis, the dominant concern of the modern critic, emerges for the first time. There is no surviving Elizabethan analysis of an Elizabethan play and no contemporary analysis of metaphysical poem. It is in Dryden's Examen of the Silent Women that we get the first elaborate critical analysis of a literary work in English. Both Saintsbury and George Watson agree that the Examen is something quite new in the history of English literary criticism. Equally unique are his enthusiastic and loving appreciations of Shakespeare, Fletcher, and Beaumont and Ben Jonson. Nothing like this had previously been seen in English, while to this day his character of Shakespeare is one of the epices of universal criticism. Dryden thus affirms at the right moment the native element in literature. Dryden is also a pioneer in the field of historical criticism. Critics up to the time had a very rudimentary sense of literary history. Dryden, on the other hand, shows a well-developed historical sense. He recognizes that the genius and temperament differ from age to age, and hence literature in different periods of history is bound to be different. He traces the decay of literature in the pre-Restoration era to historical causes and its revival to the restoration of our happiness. Thus, he recognizes that Elizabethan drama and Restoration drama are governed by different literary conventions, and that Aristotle himself might have revised his rules and written differently had he lived in the modern era. A similar sense of history is shown in his remarks on Chaucer, who wrote, "In the inefficacy of our poetry, and so perfection should not be accepted of him. We must be children before we grow men." Thus, Dryden recognizes the truth that literature is not static, but a dynamic process. It is ever growing and changing, and the rules and literary judgments also must be, as a consequence, change accordingly. Similarly, he recognizes that the temperament of a French and the English differ, and hence the literatures of the two countries are bound to be different. Indeed, he is the father of comparative criticism in England. In the essay, there is constantly weighing and balancing of the qualities of English drama as against those of the French. As Saintsbury points out, he was the greatest man of letters of the time in his country as well as in all Europe, and his strong, clear common sense and faculty of arguing a point well fitted him to the task of comparative criticism. He is the first in England to analyze English and foreign plays and examine their comparative merits and demerits. It is another matter that his cultural nationalism makes him biased and prejudiced and vitiates a little his comparative estimates. Dryden is also the pioneer of liberal classicism. He has great respect for classical rules. He has read Aristotle, Horace, the Italian and French critics, and has great respect for them, and has profited much from his study of both the ancient and modern critics, but and in this respect he resembles Longinus more than anyone else. He never can help considering the individual works of literature almost without regard to those rules and principles, and simply on the bold, the sound, and unshakable ground of the impression they make upon him. This is the statement of Saintsbury. His adherence to the rules is never slavish. In the final analysis, he trusts to his judgment and to the impression that the work as a whole, rather than in parts, makes upon him. For example, he recognizes that the blind adherence to the unities often has a cramping effect and often results in absurdities. On the other hand, their violation often results in greater variety and copiousness of plot. It is for this reason that he prefers the irregular English plays to the more regular French ones. Similarly, his liberal classicism is also seen in his noble defense of tragicomedy. Again, he considers that the aim of poetry is primarily to delight. It must move the readers to aesthetic pleasure, and instruction is only a secondary function. In this emphasis on delight as the function of poetry, he differs from all other earlier critics. Sidney also had expressed the view that poetry must move, but he meant that it must move to virtuous action. But according to Dryden, poetry must delight. It must move to an appreciation of beauty. The delight proper to poetry is aesthetic delight. The poetry instructs only as it delights. Dryden goes against Aristotle when he prefers epic to tragedy. He is most shrewd, racy, and original, and most delightful when he breaks free from the rules and trusts to his own judgment. His criticism suffers from well-marked faults. He is often prejudiced in favor of his own country and his age. Often his criticism is in the nature of special pleading. Sometimes he commits error of fact or conveniently ignores awkward facts. He is guilty of many inconsistencies and is often vague and desultory. But despite these faults, it must be acknowledged that he established the English fashion of criticizing, as Shakespeare did the English fashion of dramatizing, the fashion of aiming at delight, at truth, at justice, at nature, at poetry, and letting the rules take care of themselves. Saintsbury's statement. Summarizing Dryden's achievement as a critic, Atkin writes, "The truth was that his judgment, at its best, both in theorizing and appreciating, was of a super-rational kind. It sprang from an imaginative sympathy which soared behind anything that the pure, unaided intellect could discern. Formally, based on his own impression, his appreciations were something more than the result of acute analysis and sound reasoning, though these two played their part in confirming the faith that was in him. They were rather the result of a synthetic process which viewed the effects observed with a critical insight akin to creative vision that detected in the multiplicity of those effects." meaning and coherence, thus penetrating to the heart of thing. By his enlightened doctrine, his literary appreciations and his critical methods, he enabled readers not only to perceive fresh beauties in literature, but also to understand more clearly excellences which they had hitherto but vaguely valued, and these, after all, were the supreme tasks of criticism in all the ages. Then another subheading in this chapter is Contemporaries of Dryden. Dryden was not the only critic of Restoration era. It was a period of intense literary activity, and there were a host of critics devoting their energies to critical inquiry. Much of this criticism is worthless. Only three of Dryden's contemporaries, Thomas Rymer, John Dennis, and Jeremy Collier, deserve a passing reference. So first, let's start with Thomas Rymer. His period is 1641 to 1713. According to Macaulay, Rymer was the worst critic that ever lived. His chief critical works are three: his preface to his own translation of the French writer Rapin's Reflections on Aristotle's Poetics, published in the year 1677, and second, The Tragedies of the Last Age, in 1678, and third, A Short View of Tragedy, which appeared in 1692. From these works, we find that Rymer was a man of remarkable learning for his age and country. But, says Saintsbury, learning alone doesn't make one a great critic. He lacked true critical judgment, and this faculty of critical judgment is an inborn faculty. That he lacked the critical faculty is brought out by a brief consideration of what he had said from time to time. For example, in preface of his translation of Rapin, he writes, first, poets would grow negligent if critics had not a strict eye on their miscarriages. Yet there are critics who more envy the true poets than the false ones. Second, he examines English critical scene in the recent past and writes, in the past, England was as free from critics as from waltz. Ben Jonson alone had the necessary critical learning. Third, he examines the achievements of some masters of English poetry. About Chaucer, he says, our language was not then capable of any heroic character. Spencer, in his opinion, had a large spirit, a sharp judgment, and a genius for heroic poetry, perhaps above any that ever wrote since Virgil. But he wanted a true idea. His stanza is no way proper for our language. Then point 4. Then he passes on to examine Davenant and Collier, and after that Virgil, Aristo, etc. Obviously, all his practical criticism is superficial, and often it is also incorrect. In his second book, The Tragedies of Last Age, Rymer undertakes to point out the errors of Beaumont and Fletcher, Shakespeare and Ben Jonson. But true criticism never aims at pointing out merely the errors of composition. It aims more at appreciation and interpretation. He attempts to set the quibble catching of his countrymen right and to put an end to stage quacks and empirics in poetry, who despise the rules. He says in English play, fancy leaps and jumps and sways, she is gone, while reason rattles the chain and follows after. He wants a crub to be put on fancy, but this is nothing new. He rarely says anything new, and whatever new he has said is all rubbish. In his third book, A Short View of Tragedy, he exhibits his wide reading and vast knowledge, and there can be no doubt about his learning. But the opinions which he expresses about Shakespeare and other dramatists verge on folly. About Othello, he says, it has a phantom of a fable, but a very bad phantom. According to him, it is ridiculous that Desdemona should love a black Moor, and still more ridiculous that she should be attracted by the stories of his adventures. The most ridiculous thing in the plot of Othello is that a black Moor should be the commander-in-chief of Venice. According to him, all the characters of this play, more especially Iago, I-A-G-O, are extremely bad, because philosophy tells us it is a principle in nature of man to be grateful. Philosophy must be the poet's guide. Therefore, Iago is a poetic impossibility. This is his peculiar reasoning. It shows he has no critical sense. About Shakespeare, he says, in tragedy, Shakespeare appears quite out of his element. His brains are turned. He raves and rambles without any coherence, any spark of reason, or any rule to control him and set bound to his frenzy. Ben Jonson, in his opinion, fares slightly better, but even he gropes in the dark and jumbles things together without head and tail. About Shakespeare's versification, he says, the nagging of a horse or the howling of a mastiff possesses mere meaning than Shakespeare's words. Sainsbury comments on this view and writes, this shows that Rhymer understood the language of the beast and did not understand that of a man. And he further says, I never came across a worse critic than Thomas Rhymer. He had learning, but learning alone does not make one a great critic. He examines characters on philosophical grounds and condemns the plot of Othello because it seems impossible to him that a fair girl can fall in love with a black person. He suffered perhaps from a color prejudice. There cannot be a greater absurdity and a greater lack of critical sense. It is folly masquerading as criticism. However, by his vituperative, abusive, and violent criticism of Shakespeare and others, he succeeded in attracting much attention. He provoked several retorts, the two most important being those of Dryden and John Dennis. In this way, Shakespeare's merits and demerits were much discussed, and ultimately his many beauties and excellencies were recognized. In the history of literary criticism, Rhymer, despite all his absurdity and folly, has a secure place. for he has to his credit the distinction of a double or even a triple first. Says George Watson, Rimmer's Tragedies of the Last Age is the first critical book in English which is altogether concerned with analyzing the work of other Englishmen, and its sequel, A Short View of Tragedy, is the first pure example of literary history in English. It is an astonishing double first which the conscientious historian, however regretfully, is bound to record. Thirdly, he is the first English critic to quote abundantly in the course of his practical criticism, and though his comments on quotations are merely generalized insults, they are at least particular in their application. Again and again he poses the right questions. Though he fails to give the right answer, he has a strong sense of history, wide reading and erudition, so much so that Reardon was impressed enough by him to reply to his savage attacks on Shakespeare. He is a genius, but a perverse genius, who despite all his gifts fails to think rightly and judge correctly. The second point is, second critic is John Dennis, 1657 to 1734. In his own age, nobody paid any special attention to John Dennis. The critics of the Romantic school were not much attracted by him, but in modern times a sort of reaction has taken place in his favor. The moderns have discovered in him something of a Longinus or Coleridge and regard him as a serious and well-equipped critic. But then again, such an opinion is not based upon a sound study of his critical works. It is as one-sided as the contemporary neglect of him. John Dennis is a strange combination of good sense and folly. In his literary criticism, he comes across such intelligent remarks as this one. The circumstances of the Greek drama were perfectly different from those of the English drama, and yet, to our surprise, he betrays a sheer ignorance of the distinctive features of the English drama and a curious inability to appreciate some beautiful aspects of Greek poetry and drama, say, for example, the Lamentation of Antigone in the play of that name. He makes fun of this noble passage. Also, he is wrong-headed enough to remark that Rimmer's censure of Shakespeare in most of the particulars very sensible and just. In the pamphlet entitled Usefulness of the State to the Happiness of Mankind, to Government and to Religion, Dennis replies to Jeremy Collier and his standpoint throughout is ethical. In his assertions, which are rather dogmatic, Dennis frequently uses the word must and fails to distinguish between fact and probability. All this perversity is surprising, for Dennis was not ignorant. He was well versed both in ancient and modern literature and criticism. He had the good taste to appreciate Reardon, and in his attack on Pope, he has the intelligence enough to point out some of his real weaknesses. Yet he displays, as no good critic should, the manifold weaknesses of his time and school, both in general and in particular. He altered Shakespeare's Mary wipes off Windsor into the comical gallant, to which he appended a preface in which he finds fault with the original as having no less than three accents. He was not able to appreciate the spirit behind a work of art, and his accounts for his hostile and perverse criticism of Shakespeare. Further, he complains in his preface to The Comical Gallant that in the second part of the Henry IV, Falstaff does nothing but talk, and expresses the view that humor, not wit, is the business of comedy. Obviously, this is a very wrong and misleading statement. Real comedy evokes thoughtfulness and makes an intellectual appeal. A true comedy has wit as well as humor. Further, he judges Shakespeare by Rymer's principle of poetic justice, finds a painful disregard of poetic justice in his plays, and so condemns Shakespeare. He forgets that poetic justice is not a fact of life, and Shakespeare is disregarding it as being merely true to life. The same wrong-headedness is seen in his remarks on Pope's The Rape of the Lock. Instead of appreciating the brilliant wit of this delicious little thing, he finds fault with the machinery of the poem. His chief works of criticism are three. First, the advancement and reformation of poetry. Second, the impartial critic. And third, grounds of criticism in poetry. In all these works, he endeavors to elaborate an arbitrary and narrow theory of poetry, that poetry is necessarily religious. Second, it has for its real end and reformation of the mind, for a sort of catharsis of the spirit. Poetry, in his opinion, also improves the mind by paying careful attention to the rules of art. And he repeatedly emphasizes the need of poetic justice. He admires Milton's poetry as it has a religious aim. Obviously, he narrows down the scope of poetry when he suggests that poets should shape poetry according to theological and ethical ideas of the glory of God. In other words, he makes poetry a handmaid to theology. Commenting on his poetic theory, Sainsbury rightly says, "In this way, easily comes bad poetry, not at all the good, and it excludes poetic varieties which may be as good as the best written in obedience to it and better." By no stretch of imagination we can call Gray's Elegy as a religious poem, and the love sonnets of Shakespeare also cannot be termed as religious, but their beauty and nobility have a universal appeal. Dennis is an advocate of rules and imitation of ancients. He accepts the dictum, "To follow nature is to follow them." His critical doctrines are mostly derived from Aristotle and Horace, as well as from their French imitators. And yet, despite all his pseudo-classicism, there is a romantic strain in his critical temper. For example, in his Advancement and Reformation of Poetry, he says, "Passion is the characteristic merit of poetry, and therefore it must be everywhere." There must be passion then, and that must be distinct from ordinary passion, and there must also be enthusiasm. In his use of word enthusiasm, Dennis reminds us of Longinus. He adds further, everything that pleases and consequently moves in the poetic diction is passion, whether it be ordinary or enthusiastic. This shows the influence of Longinus. Now, no subject is so capable of supplying us with thoughts that necessarily produce these great and strong enthusiasms. As a religious subject, for all which is great in religion is most exalted and amazing. All that is joyful is transporting, and all that is sad is dismal, and all that is terrible is astonishing. The purpose of poetry, according to Dennis, is to delight through the depiction of passion. It is this religious bias of Dennis which makes him such an enthusiastic admirer of Milton's Christian epic, which provides ample material for wonder, terror, and transport. He wanted to restore poetry to all its greatness and to all its innocence by making religion its proper subject. Then his third contemporary critic is Jeremy Collier. His period is 1650 to 1726. No account of literary criticism during the Restoration can be considered complete without a mention of Jeremy Collier's A Short View of the Profaneness and Immortality of English Stage. This frontal attack on indecency and licentiousness of Restoration drama did much to focus attention on the many vulgarities and obscenities of the contemporary drama. The attack was so effective that dramatists were compelled to take note of it. As a result of Collier's attack, the Restoration drama was considered as something worthless, below the notice of decent people all through the 18th and 19th centuries, and it is only in the modern age that it has come to be regarded as literature once again. And friends, with this we come to the end of this chapter, Neoclassic Criticism, Dryden and His Contemporaries.